Lillian Vasquez with Lifestyles on KVCR. Thanks for listening. Earth Day is recognized every April 22nd, or at least that's when we officially recognize it. But really, every day could be Earth Day just by paying a little more attention to our environment and how we can better serve it. Today on Lifestyles, I'll talk with ESRI Chief Scientist Dr. Dawn Wright. She'll share details about our ocean and the importance of understanding it, what Earth Day means to her, and we'll learn more about ESRI, the International Geographic Information System software company located right here in the Inland Empire. It's coming up on Lifestyles with me, Lillian Vasquez, right after the news. Yeah, the simple things in
life. Support for Lifestyles on KVCR comes from Dr. Ingrid Trinkle in Redlands, providing medical and cosmetic dermatology, including PicoA laser treatments for tattoo removal. Information and a list of services online at clearmyink.com.
Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. My guest is Dawn Wright. She is the chief scientist for ESRI, the Environmental Systems Research Institute located in Redlands. Dawn, welcome.
Thank you very much.
I have so many questions as we explore your career and your many contributions to science. I'd like to begin by getting to know you first. Will you share your background, where you grew up, your first science project before the age of 12, and what led you into this field?
Well, I started off, our family moved different places, but my formative years were in Hawaii. I grew up on Maui, Hawaii, but my family is from Baltimore, Maryland on my mother's side and Charleston, South Carolina on my father's side. But through a series of interesting circumstances, we ended up in Hawaii, and I went to elementary and high school there, and that's where the interest in science really took hold. Growing up on an island with constant access to the ocean, I became convinced very early on that I wanted to study the ocean as a scientist. At first, I thought I would be an astronaut. I think a lot of people start off this way, wanting to be an astronaut or wanting to be a marine biologist. But I decided to get interested in marine geology because I was so interested in the volcanic rocks and the different colors of sands on the beaches in Hawaii. Even though I was influenced by Jacques Cousteau, so many scientists of my generation were influenced by him and his Sunday morning specials right before The Wonderful World of Disney. My TV regimen was The Wonderful World of Disney and then Jacques Cousteau. I did figure out, though, that Jacques Cousteau was a wonderful photographer, underwater photographer, but I really wanted to know how things worked and how the ocean worked. So I decided early on to pursue a career in ocean science. And at that time, it was somewhat difficult to find out how to go about doing that because there wasn't the internet back then. So I'm already giving away my age. There was no internet. There were no smartphones. And so you had to go to a library and sit down with a book and open books and read about.
So when the rest
things.
Of us were telling our parents we're going to the library to study and do homework, you really were.
Yes. Well, for the most part, I was, yes. I really enjoyed pouring through books initially about space, but more and more about the oceans. And then I found all these different college catalogs. Even today, it's not quite as straightforward to get a degree in oceanography at the bachelor level. So you normally have to get a degree first in either biology or, in my case, geology or chemistry or physics. And then when you go to graduate school, that's where most of our oceanography degree programs are. In my case, I got my degree in oceanography from Texas A&M University and went on from there.
So I took oceanography in college. I took it three times. The first two times I took television courses because I was just trying to take what I thought was going to be an easy science to get a grade and get a C and move on.
Uh-huh.
Wrong. So then I took a true oceanography class at Cal State Northridge, and I passed, but only with the C. So I just wanted to share the level of science-minded that I am. So as we continue this conversation.
Well, that's a C is a very good grade for oceanography. I would say I taught oceanography for 17 years at Oregon State University and taught the large enrollment class where students were not science majors. and they were needing their science credit, so they were in my class. And I would say a C is a pretty good grade, because in oceanography, you do have to learn about all those four basic sciences so that you can understand how the ocean works. So you get sort of the kitchen sink thrown at you.
I'm speaking with Dawn Wright. She's the chief scientist for ESRI. Was it your job, or did you teach it this way as a professor? When you knew you were teaching the large lecture classes, you obviously knew they weren't science majors, mm-hmm. for the most part. Did you try and break it down a little bit? Because it was, like I said, I passed on the third time taking it, so that gives you an idea. I was, by the third time, familiar with words. I was familiar with definitions. Mm-hmm. I did a little better. So when you were teaching, were you minded of that, or were you only minded of, this is the information I want to instill in these students?
No, it was very important to break it down. And for me, teaching that class was one of the best training grounds for science communication, because... And I ended up teaching this class with a teaching partner, and together we figured out that you definitely have to break it down. And so we used to say, we're going to teach you about the oceans from the standpoint of a bathtub. So you start with an empty bathtub, and the bathtub and the bottom of the bathtub is the ocean floor and geology. So that's where we'll start off with geology. Then we're going to fill that bathtub with water. And so that's where you're going to learn about chemistry, why the water is salty, why ocean pollution is a problem. And then we're going to go up to the level of the bathtub where you get into the water. That's the surface. And why? What are the waves on top of that? How do you make the waves in the bathtub? And so that's the physics, the physical oceanography. And then, of course, you're going to want to put rubber duckies or toys in that bathtub. And so that's the ocean life. And so we're going to end up this course teaching you about what you thought this course was all about, which is about fishes and whales, but there's so much more to it than that.
Well, you just painted a beautiful picture for me. I don't remember my professor painting it quite that way, but I have a great visual of what you just described. So thank you so much. We mentioned that you're the chief scientist for ESRI. Jack Dangerman is a longtime resident of Redlands who co-founded ESRI, which used to be called ESRI, now ESRI, in 1969 with his wife, Laura. Can you share a little about his background and his startup company and how it's come to serve our world? How did it begin for him?
Well, I think it began for he and Laura, his wife, as a dream, really, because they instill in us at ESRI this idea of we are helping to fulfill this vision along with them of making the world a better place, literally through maps and through geography and providing data and services. We also do quite a bit with conservation, which is still one of their passions. And they started off with this dream or this vision in terms of, well, let's have a consulting firm. And so ESRI, or you can still say ESRI, because it's literally an acronym for the Environmental Systems Research Institute. And so they started off as more of a landscape architecture consulting firm. And they had clients, and they did various types of projects. And the software that they built in order to do these landscape architecture and ecology and other types of projects became so vital to their clients that their clients asked them to do more with providing the actual software.
Oh.
And so they moved from a services company to a software company. And that started in 1969, and I believe it's okay for me to say that it started with just $1,100 of their money, but now it's a multi-billion dollar company, and we are in about 350,000 organizations around the world, and we have around, I'd say on the ESRI campus, we have a little over 2,000 employees at that headquarters campus, but we have over 50 offices across the country and a whole network of distributors around the world, so that brings our total employee count to anywhere from 4,000 to 5,000.
Wow.
And the interesting thing about ESRI is that we produce this software, ArcGIS and ArcGIS Online, but we still have a services component to the company that stretches back to its roots. So there's still a division of ESRI that's called Professional Services, and that's literally our environmental consulting firm within the company. And so Professional Services does a lot of wonderful work with individual clients, helping them to implement mapping solutions. And sometimes they go above and beyond what's in our core software to help those customers. And these customers can be all kinds of businesses, other consulting firms, government agencies, but they do quite a bit of this service part of the profession as well. And professional services for my job is a really neat division, because a lot of the environmental scientists at Esri are within that professional services division. We have a lot of science that goes on at the company. Science underpins what we build for our software, but it's also what we do in terms of our services. We have environmental scientists of all different types. And in my role as chief scientist, I advise across the company in terms of ecological science and agricultural science, conservation biology, geology and geophysics, climate science, and most recently, the ocean science.
You're a professor in geography and oceanography at the Oregon State University, which you mentioned, and you had decided to take a leave for that and maybe test the being a chief scientist, test it out and see if it was what it was and maybe what you would want to do. But you're now the chief scientist now of Esri. What falls on your desk and what type of tasks falls in your position? You were starting to mention them, but what are you most focused on?
Yeah, and that's it's sort of funny how it worked out, because when I was actually hired as chief scientist in 2011, and Jack Dangerman said, okay, you're permanent. So when I came to Esri, I was considered permanent and full-time, but at the same time, I had taken a two-year leave of absence from Oregon State University. And my intention was to go back to Oregon State University, but Jack and his company drew me in so deeply, and there was so much to do that I decided to switch my status at Oregon State. So I'm still affiliated with them, but I am full-time at Esri, and it's because of the many things that fall on my desk. So Jack and the other directors at Esri, we do much more than create the software, and we do the professional services that I mentioned, but we also function as a member of the scientific community. And so that's my job at Esri, is to represent our company as a member of the scientific community rather than just a company that produces a product. I give of my time on editorial boards, on scientific advisory committees. At Esri, we do a lot of work with the United Nations and with the National Science Foundation and with government agencies such as NASA and the U.S. Geological Survey and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Many of these agencies that do environmental science and that do a lot of mapping and need and produce a lot of Earth data. And so because that's core to what we produce at Esri, we also give of ourselves, so to speak, in terms of a science advisor. And so that's part of my role.
Well, you must have a hectic schedule and travel quite a bit if you're serving on so many things and sharing your voice and Esri's voice.
There's a lot of travel that's involved. Yeah, but thankfully I have some miles built up, some frequent flyer miles, so it's not all bad.
After the break, I'll continue my conversation with Dr. Don Wright, author and former professor in oceanography and geography, and she's the chief scientist for ESRI. We'll talk about why understanding the ocean is so important, and she'll share what Earth Day means to her, and we'll talk briefly about Legos. You're listening to Lifestyles. I'm Lillian Vasquez. My guest is Dr. Don Wright. She has worn many hats in the field of science. She has authored or co-authored more than 150 articles and 10 books on marine GIS, hydrothermal activity and tectonic of mid-ocean ridges, and marine data modeling. We continue our conversation talking about her time at sea. As an oceanographer, I'm sure you've been on many sea adventures. I'm guessing that's where you get the name Deep Sea Don. Do you get seasick?
Yes, I do. And so this is full disclosure. So for those of you who are considering a career in oceanography, don't let this stop you. So I have an inner ear problem, and I always get seasick for the first 2 days of an ocean voyage. But it just takes me the 48 hours to get the crystals in my ear and everything equilibrated, and then I'm fine. So that was something that I had to overcome.
Wow.
But it's so, so worth it. There have been a lot of adventures at sea, and for about 3 years, I had a job where I was at sea for 6 months out of the year. So I had a long time to get equilibrated and get my sea legs.
Wow, I would think so.
Yeah.
I'm speaking with Dawn Wright. She's the chief scientist for Esri. I'm told that mapping land is much easier than mapping the ocean. Why is mapping the ocean so important to our society?
Well, first of all, we are living on a planet that is a water planet. So we've got about 71 to 75% of our planet is water. And we depend on the ocean for something as basic as breathing. Over half of the oxygen that we breathe comes from the ocean. And from your oceanography class, hopefully you learned about air-sea interactions on the surface of the ocean, where there are exchanges of gases, and the oceans actually produce a lot of the oxygen that we breathe all over the world. And then in terms of climate change, we're all pretty familiar with global warming now. And regardless of whether you believe that global warming is caused by humans, which I do, and which the scientific community has agreed upon, or not, the oceans absorb all of the, not all, but a good portion of the carbon dioxide or greenhouse gases that are in our atmosphere. So the oceans are really a buffer of life for us. And then there's the basic transportation issue, where a lot of our goods are transported on cargo ships. We have a successful internet because of the telecommunication cables that are on the ocean floor, stretching across all of the oceans. So from Europe to the East Coast, that's one part of the internet that we have, because those cables are connected. We have our global connectivity because of that. Then there's the nutrition that we get from the oceans in terms of our fisheries. One of the most important benefits is just our renewal and recreation, and just being able to go to the beach or to travel in a sailboat, or just the idea of watching the sunset, or snorkeling or diving, or the national parks. You know, we have a whole series of national parks that are underwater that a lot of us did not realize until the work of Sylvia Earle and her Sustainable Seas expeditions in around 2003, I believe, where she succeeded in exploring and raising public awareness about all of the national parks or extensions of the national parks that are underwater. That we have here in the United States that we can all visit.
I had no idea. Thank you. One of the things that I wanted to know a little bit about, if you can share, about the task and the challenge of finding the Malaysian airline that's mm-hmm. just been put upon you. Can you share a little bit about that?
First of all, such a great tragedy for listeners who are unfamiliar. There was the MH370 or Malaysian Air 370 airplane that basically disappeared into thin air. And to this day, we are still it's been several years now, trying to find that plane. And there was an international effort that was launched. And this, they were flying over the Indian Ocean. So the plane was last heard from over the Indian Ocean. And so that's where the effort has been in terms of scouring the surface of the ocean and deploying equipment that will also map the ocean floor to find that wreckage. Now, Esri was not involved in actually going to sea. We did not participate in that, but our software has been used to create the maps of the search areas. And I think a lot of the credit for the search thus far goes to the nation of Australia and Geosciences Australia, that government agency, because they've taken on a good portion of the role of putting together all of the data that were collected. Now, to this day, we still don't know where that plane is. And there are explorers such as David Gallo, who used to be the director of special projects at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution. He and other scientists, there's still this desire, of course, to put together the resources, additional resources, to continue searching at sea for that plane. But Geosciences Australia has been working specifically with us in putting together a story map that gives you the story of that whole search effort. And I'd be very pleased to send you the link for that story map so that your listeners can look at that. I mean, this, again, was a horrible, horrible, unimaginable tragedy. But a small bright spot is that there's so much of the ocean that is unexplored and that we still don't have detailed maps for. But in doing this search for this missing plane, there was so much fantastic data that were collected that that's now available to the scientific community, and we now have a much better idea of the structure of the Indian Ocean seafloor in many of those places.
Wow. I know our time is short and we're running out of it, but I want to ask a couple more questions. First, what does Earth Day mean to you, and what do you want it to mean to the rest of us for this planet?
Well, what Earth Day means to me, and I believe Earth Day was founded by a gentleman from the Inland Empire, so we can be thankful for that because it springs from our area, and it's certainly appropriate for Californians because we care so much about the environment here, and we love to get outside. And for me, Earth Day is just an acknowledgement that the Earth is our home that should be treasured and preserved. Earth is a sacred place. And so to me, Earth Day is my day to go to church, so to speak, about the Earth. But it doesn't matter what religion you are. If you don't have any religion, we all live here on this Earth, and we are facing so many crises now that we all need to be aware of that and to pay attention and to do our part. All of us can recycle, all of us can preserve water, all of us can make sure that when we see trash in our neighborhood to pick it up. These are the basic tenets, I think, of Earth Day. I think last year the emphasis was on planting trees. That's another thing that we can do, but that's what it means to me.
And hopefully that's what it means to our listeners and our society, of taking care of our Earth as best we can in our own little environment.
Yes.
Right? Okay, and lastly, do you have a Lego that's inspired by you?
Oh, well, there is a Lego minifig. So for those of you who aren't familiar with the Lego universe and haven't had a chance to see any of the Lego movies, the people in the Lego universe are called minifigs. And now with each Lego set that you get, there's always a little person or people that go with the set. And so there's a wonderful person who I've not yet met who lives up in Sonoma County, and he created a Deep Sea Dawn minifig and sent the pieces to me to put together within my own little marine GIS lab. So I can, so it's quite an honor.
Wow.
I value that more than my PhD.
Wow. My guest has been Dawn Wright. She's the chief scientist for ESRI, the Environmental Systems Research Institute, located in Redlands. Dawn, thank you so much for sharing a little bit more about our planet.
Oh, thank you so much. This has been a delight.
Thanks. That's Dr. Dawn Wright, chief scientist for ESRI in Redlands. ESRI is focused on a greater engagement with the ocean science community. To support a better understanding of our ocean, ESRI aims to improve and expand its services, partnerships, and connections with the broad ocean community. The link that Dawn mentioned regarding the Malaysian flight that was lost at sea is on our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles. That's our show. Thanks to all who helped to make the show possible, including David Fleming, Shireen Awad, Sean Houlihan, Roger Ashheim, and executive producer Rick Dulock. Our theme music is provided by Ethan Bortnick. If you'd like to hear any of my past interviews, go to our website at kvcrnews.org/lifestyles and click on the interview you'd like to hear. While you're there, leave me a message or share an idea for an upcoming segment for the show. You can also share your top favorite movies with me. Thanks for listening. Join me next week at the same time for Lifestyles with Lillian Vasquez. Bye for now.
Yeah, the simple things in life.
Support for Lifestyles on KVCR comes from Dr. Ingrid Trinkle in Redlands, providing medical and cosmetic dermatology, including PicoA laser treatments for tattoo removal. Information and a list of services online at clearmyinc.com.